Forged from the fires that created a long-lost brotherhood of podcasts comes the Blast Syndicate. We are made up of Focus on Metal, Inside Metal, Iron City Rocks, Mars Attacks, Metal Geeks, MSR Cast, Neckbreaker, Radioactive Metal, and Wiki Metal. We are the Blast Syndicate. Go to BlastSyndicate.com to find out more. Get blasted.
Hey, this is Greg Renoff, author of Van Halen Rising, and you're listening to Focus on Metal. Focus on Metal!
Hey, metalheads, welcome to yet another episode of Focus on Metal. And finally, back in the studio again is Richie.
Yep, I'm on the good books.
It's been so long. The last episode, I had to tell people, hey, he's still with us.
No, I'm still around. It's called having a seven-month-old daughter.
Yeah.
Things happen.
They do.
My fault, anyway.
So. she had her last.
I did.
So, it's good to have you back, and... You know, I was kind of bummed that you missed out on the interview that we're doing this week.
I wanted to do it, but these things happen. I couldn't get down. You know, the show must go on, as they say.
Yeah, great guest this week. So much good stuff out of Greg that we're not even doing track of the week this week, because just the guy had some great stuff to talk about, and it's going to well take up the hour. So I just figured let's go with that. So, you know, obviously, really good book, you know, going back into that early days and a lot of information about stuff that, you know, you may or may not know. But, you know, what I talked to Greg about with this, too, was what I thought was really cool is, you know, you go back to Bob's documentary. And, you know, all the guys are talking about the parties and all of that stuff. And this book really fleshes out all of that stuff that, you know, for you sitting over in Ireland and me sitting over in the East Coast is like a totally foreign thing to us.
Yeah.
To Bob, I mean, he lived through this. It's second nature to him. But to get really the background of where Van Halen came out of, the whole cultural scene they come out of, really, this book puts that together for you.
Yeah, well, a lot, like most of the book is pre-78.
Yeah.
Like it's a prehistory of the band. I think it only covers like Van Halen 1 and maybe a bit of Van Halen 2.
It's just 1 and the tour for 1.
Yeah, and that's it.
And that's it. And we go into that in the interview talking to Greg about, you know, why that is. But, I mean, I think he does a really perfect cutoff. One, I mean, it does leave you like wanting more, but I just think it was the right cutoff. And the way the book is structured, it's very balanced. And I think that if he had continued on, you would have had these chapters that I know that you and I both hate, which is almost like the gratuitous, oh, how did those 5 years just go by in 3 pages kind of a thing, you know? So what he's done with this book and the way he structured it and laid it out, it's none of that. It's very balanced from year to year of what's going on. There's not a lot of like, wait a minute, where did all that time go kind of a thing. It really takes you on a cool journey. And in some cases, you know, parallel what Dave's doing, what the Van Halen brothers are doing. And it's like I said, it's just a really good book and gives you a lot of insight into the band and also a lot of insight into how people react to the band. So our buddy Tracy G is mentioned in the book several times. And what I liked, and I told Greg this, is I like the fact that it isn't like Tracy is just on one spot in the book. He's got an interaction with Eddie at one point, and then a few years later, and then you get taken on like Tracy's journey with how the band progressed as well. So you get to see this through his eyes and how that is. Because for me, and what I told Greg is, I mean, I went out and I bought the Van Halen album in 78 and put that on. It was like, holy crap. But the only point of reference I had was that piece of vinyl. I didn't have seeing the band, their history. Not, I just have this plunk that thing down and hear that. But for Tracy, here's this guy who's seeing them right along. And a lot of other people in the book, too, are seeing them right along. So you get to go on that little journey, too. And a lot of books don't do that. But this one does it. It's pretty nice the way he did it.
Yeah, it's getting great reviews. I think I got hit. I didn't even know this was out. I got hit up, you know, you buy stuff on Amazon and they send you emails.
Yeah.
So I got a hit up about this and I was like, wow, I wonder what this book is about. And then I said, oh, it's a prehistory book. And I'm like, well, that sounds interesting. So I said, right, we'll try and get the author on.
Yeah.
Of course, we got Greg on. And the book is getting rave reviews everywhere.
Yeah.
Obviously, the amount of research to do something like this is pretty, pretty extensive. Because a lot of the stuff with the albums is probably out there. They would have done interviews for all the records, you know, so you would add source material there. But when you're going prehistory for Van Halen. Yeah.
But even the records, you know. Obviously there are a lot of interviews out there, but who are they interviewing? They're interviewing...
Well, Michael Anthony's in it, isn't he?
Yes, yeah. But they're, you know, who are they interviewing? They're interviewing Dave, they're interviewing Eddie, maybe they're interviewing Alex, but they're not talking to Ted Templeman.
No.
They're not talking to Don Landy. And that's who Greg is left talking to. And I freaking love that.
Yeah.
Because now you're getting other bits behind there that you didn't realize before. And so it's amazing to get Ted and Don's perspective and also to find out just how integral those guys were to the whole signing process as well. That, you know, maybe was never brought out either. And, you know, and you've got other people in there, you know, they talk about George Lynch and stuff like that. And you just get a nice continuation of what Bob presents in his documentary, but then just a lot more. And I think, you know, for anybody that's an old school Van Halen fan, they're really going to like this book a lot. And I think it gives a lot of good perspective. And what I talked to Greg about is, you know, usually, especially now, you know, here we are with this 2020 hindsight, right? So a lot of Van Halen fans, they fall into one or two camps, right? They fall into the Eddie camp or the Dave camp, right? So you start reading this book and even Greg talks about the fact that, you know, the original intent was more about Eddie. The book takes you along his mindset where you suddenly realize that how much Dave actually contributed to the band and what they became.
Mm.
And because people who sit in the Eddie camp think, well, Dave's an ass clown and, you know, all the bullshit that he does and everything else. And you don't understand like what Dave's whole part of this was because you're tied into this massive musicianship of the Van Halen brothers. But then on the other hand, as Greg points out, without someone like Dave, you probably wouldn't have had that success story that they have because these guys were going out and they were playing, you know, whole album sides of you know, like Cactus and stuff like that. That's not going to get you signed and that's not going to get you out there. You needed to have that the David Lee Roth song and dance injection in there as well. So it's kind of neat that the way that they have the whole thing presented in the book. And you know, a lot of times books, when they go this way, you get this definite thing of, I see where the author's slanting themselves or where maybe their allegiance lies. And in this, you really kind of get this other thing where you can see where Greg started it. But then as he learned more and as he talked to more people, he started to go on an equal footing with both of those people.
Yeah.
And that makes the book an incredibly balanced book. And it makes you want to read it, like every detail about it because of that. And just amazing stuff that's in there that again, if you didn't live in California and you didn't get to see them live or you didn't get to experience any of that whole time frame. I mean, I just keep thinking back to like the freaking house parties, like thousands and thousands of kids, you know, out in these backyards and how Van Halen kept upping the game with what they would do when they would do these house parties. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Just an amazing band. I didn't get into Van Halen until, I think Roth was gone. And I remember buying the Van Halen 1 and I thought 1978 it came out. This is just going to be this bluesy kind of ZZ Top kind of,
yeah.
Until they found their feet and I put it on straight away. I was like, holy shit. So I can imagine the effect that had in 78 when that came out first.
Yeah.
It's like, this sounds like nothing that was out at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you had Eddie doing Eruption and all that. And I always was interested to see how a band went from where they started to getting a sound like that.
Yeah.
Because no other band at that time, I don't think. I know they might say Montrose. They got the blueprint from the Montrose album. Ted Templeman did that as well. But no other band in 78 that I've listened back to sounded at all like Van Halen.
Right.
Like, they have and have always had their own sound. You just know it's Van Halen.
Right.
Be it Eddie's guitar, be it the way he plays with Michael Anthony and Alex. You just know it's Van Halen.
Yeah.
Just, their albums are timeless. They're amazing records. The first six albums are amazing.
Yeah, well, I think you got a couple of ingredients there, right, that make that perfect storm. So, yeah, you've got Eddie's playing, and the fact that he's a sponge and he's absorbing all these techniques, and he's really a fan of the guitar and of music. So you have that. You got Dave who says, hey, you know, we need to have harmony vocals in here. You know, I mean, you talk about the early years of Van Halen, and it's Eddie singing, and Eddie hated singing. And so you get Dave, who really wasn't a great singer, but he was a great showman, right? Then you got Michael who comes in. Now you got this person that can do the high parts. Now you can start working those harmonies. You can get that stuff going. So you have all of those ingredients. And then, you know, you bring in the production team that knows, like you said, from Montrose, hey, what works? What's going to really work? We got to keep this thing. We got to have mids in here. We got to have the right harmonies. We got to have the right times. You know, they refer back to, you know, we talk about the demos that the band did with Gene Simmons. And, you know, they talk about like Running with the Devil and how that initially how that song was. And now how Ted said, well, look, this is how we have to make this time instead and all that. And getting the right times for the songs, the right feelings, the right grooves and all of that stuff. And then it just, for that time period, it was just, I don't know, it was crunchy. It was bright. It was very different. And it wasn't slick. You know what I mean? There was like a lot of stuff that was on the radio at that point was all just like, it was just freaking polished. And this.
Yeah. But those early records were recorded in like 10 days.
Yeah. But all the other stuff that was on the radio at that point.
Well, you're talking about ELO, Journey.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, it was all
Van Halen,
really,
no keyboards then.
Really polished and compressed, you know, compression for FM and all that stuff. And then all of a sudden you got this thing that it has a certain liveness to it. In some cases, the songs, they almost feel like they're going to fall apart at any second. You know what I mean? You something like Jamie's Crying, like the breakdown, it just almost feels like it's just going to fall off the cliff. You know what I mean? Like they reach this point and suddenly they figured, oh, wait a minute, we'll turn left here, and they bring it back in. But you never heard that on the radio, you know, that thing where you just, it grabs you like where are these guys going to go to next? And I think it was also just, it brought this whole like California thing of like, you know, it's fun. Yeah. Party, you know, drive around and all of that. It just kind of, brought that in a very unique way.
Yeah. Just an incredible band.
And it was just, you know, to me again, you know, we're not talking having MTV. We're not talking about having, you know, the internet, not being able to see them or whatever, and just pulling that thing out. And literally all you've got is the back cover. That's, you know what I mean? Because the front cover, you get there's minimal information on that cover. That's all you have to go by. Pop that on and be like, holy crap. I mean, not a bad song on the whole damn album. And then, you know, You hear, you know, like how they did You Really Got Me, you know, which again is a, you know, Ted Templeman saying, hey, look, we got to have this kind of traditional single on here. Let's do a cover version. And the way they do that song, again, it's like, well, wow, this is, you know, it made this extra connection that didn't just make them this like little like oddball entity. You know, like, oh, all right, I get it. And then obviously Eruption, you hear, turn that on, and as a guitar player, you're like, what the hell's going on here? Like, seriously, holy crap, you know?
Yeah, I love that record. I was blown away when I put it on first because I didn't know what to expect. I wasn't a massive Van Halen fan. Van Halen to me were Jump.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of poppier stuff, I'll Wait. And then I put this thing on, I'm like, holy shit, like, this is what I wanted Van Halen to sound like.
Yeah.
You know, I love all the albums it wrote. I love 1984 as much as I love Van Halen 1.
But yeah,
when I put on Van Halen 1, I was like, holy crap.
Yeah, I mean,
amazing.
All that stuff is, you know, pre-84 is, you know, pretty cool stuff. You know, again, 2, it's a great follow-up
to
1.
I think
not as 100% as strong as one.
Fair Warning's great.
Fair Warning is amazing.
Oh yeah,
because now they started to play a little bit more with some textures, and it actually got heavier.
Mm.
You know, and I mean, you start talking about like Mean Streets, and it's like, fuck yeah,
Unchained.
Yeah. You know, it just got really gritty. And then Women and Children First started to get a little bit of bluesiness in there as well. A little bit more spaciousness in the songs. And that's, you know, again, pretty cool. And then, you know, Diver Down.
One too, cover too many, maybe?
It's, yeah. I guess Diver Down has got, it's probably their eclectic album, you know. And I guess it connected to some people. But I just felt to me like, nah. But, you know, those first couple ones, just freaking amazing albums. But, you know, I just still to this day, and I still have that, you know, I have all that vinyl, but to put that one on and just sitting there going, what the hell's going on? And hearing every solo and the fact that you didn't have a rhythm guitar behind the solo either,
yeah.
You know, that he was just, it was the one guy. And I think that also lended some of that liveness to it as well. Like, wow, this must be what it sounds like live, because there isn't this extra guitar coming in out of nowhere.
Yeah, so, and all the albums are half an hour long. They're like, yeah. Put them on, boom.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah. Good stuff. So,
yeah.
Well, anyways, instead of us continuing to talk about how great it is, let's run my conversation with Greg. Guys love when we have authors on the show, and I have got a great one on tonight. That would be the one and only Greg Renoff, just released an awesome book on Van Halen, the early years of Van Halen, something that doesn't get talked about a heck of a lot. The book's called Van Halen Rising. How are we doing tonight, Greg?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Like I said, great book, and something that I think really doesn't get dealt with a lot is that whole idea of the early years. Now, doing this and going to publishers and saying that you were going to do a book that's from the early years right up through the release and first tours of the album, was that a hard sell to publishers, or were they really on board with it?
You know, it was a bit of a hard sell, actually. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One, I'm not a guy who had written a trade book before, so I didn't have, reputation as a rock writer. So I think that might have been a little bit difficult for a sell. The other thing I think was that a lot of people were like, well, you know, you're only going to tell the early years. What about, you know, the breakup, and what about Sammy, and what about all the other stuff that went on? And I really tried to make the case in the book proposal when you try to sell to publishers, that this was the more interesting part of the story, especially because it hadn't been told. I meant more interesting in part because we know a lot about the 1985 breakup. We know a lot about the back and forth with Sammy and Eddie, but we didn't know a lot about backyard parties and about wet t-shirt contests and about how Van Halen worked from 1973 to 1977 to get a record deal. What actually happened when they went to New York with Gene Simmons? What happened when Ted Templeman walked through the Starwood and saw them in 1977? What was the making of Van Halen 1 really like? And so those are the things to me that were the untold stories about the band. And I tried to make the case, but I think eventually ECW Press was exactly the right press. They're indie out of Toronto. They do all Neil Peart's books from Rush, and they've been absolutely fantastic, and it ends up being a perfect match.
I'm glad that somebody finally got behind it, too, because you're right. There's just this whole amazing story, and for me, I mean, it brought back a lot of really cool memories, you know, especially from, you know, me getting into Van Halen back in those days, having those albums, and also playing in bands around that time period, too. And I mean, a lot of what you talk about in the book, I can relate to a lot of the crap that they went through. So it spoke to me in a lot of different ways. And I think it's probably going to speak to a lot of people the same way.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. I mean, for me, one of the things I really wanted to do was to recapture what L.A. was like in the middle of the 70s, and really what the whole music industry was like. And that's sort of the thesis of the book, which has caused some back and forth online, as you might imagine, about them saving heavy metal. What I meant by that was that we think about what we would now call hard rock, but what would have been called heavy metal at the time. By the late 70s, it was sort of a sense in America that it was kind of played out, that Led Zeppelin maybe was past their peak, Sabbath was near done, of course Deep Purple had broken up, Grand Funk had broken up, and so there was more of a sense that maybe AOR rock was going to be the wave of the future. And then the other types of music that seemed to be much more vibrant. Punk rock, for example, if you like harder, more aggressive music. And so I really wanted to capture what Van Halen was up against. You know, they're coming from a city that had given birth to the Eagles, and of course Fleetwood Mac had sort of camped out in L.A. at that period of time. Soft rock was huge. Disco, of course, was huge. And so for me, you know, when Van Halen breaks through in 1978, their way of approaching music with the very aggressive guitar solos, of course, Eruption becomes a blueprint for basically every guitar player after that who wants to sort of make a name for himself. And then the way Roth was presented on vinyl and live with the screams and the yelps and the leather pants sort of, you know, flashing that metal image. And of course, we can look at Van Halen 1 today and say, well, it's, you know, Slayer's metal, Metallica's metal. Van Halen 1's not a metal album, so to speak, but it was definitely the hardest thing in the top 40 at that time. And those guys, you know, those guys really did wave the flag in a lot of ways for some of the stuff that a lot of people said, you know, it's just old hat. Do I want to see another Ritchie Blackmore solo? You know, a lot of people in L.A. who didn't know any better thought that Eddie Van Halen was just another rehash of Ritchie Blackmore. And that was, you know, wrong.
Right. And it's also cool that, you know, you really brought out a lot of that early L.A. scene. And it's really interesting. You know, my friend Bob Nalbandian had just recently, he put out a documentary Inside L.A. Metal. So you read this book and you know, you have a lot of the same characters that Bob talked to, like, you know, like you talked to Greg Leon and stuff. And I think between what you read in your book, which is really Van Halen focused, and what you see in Bob's documentary, those two things give you this really, really awesome view of what it actually was like versus what everyone thinks it was like.
I couldn't agree more. Bob's a great guy. I'm a big fan of his work, of his radio shows, and then, of course, the documentary. And Bob is right on target with that stuff. I mean, when you look at who was playing on the scene in L.A., just among guitar players, I think it sort of has fallen by the wayside in a lot of people's minds to you know, because Eddie was so great and Randy was so great, but as you know, George Lynch came out of that scene.
Right.
Rusty Anderson, you know, obviously not a heavy metal guitarist, but a guy who now plays with Paul McCartney. It's a pretty amazing gig. He was gigging on that scene. Tommy Gervin, another guy who plays with Eddie Money now, had a band at that time that was successful, and it seemed like another band that was going to go. They were called Smile. It seemed like they were going to be a band that was going to get signed.
Right.
Greg Leon, as you mentioned, absolute monster guitar player. And I could keep going. And so there was, you know, any night you went to a club in L.A. where there was hard rock music from local bands, you were seeing guys who were pro guitar players, in effect. Right. I mean, they were full-on. These were not like high school kids who just plugged in their amps and just played. And these guys were full-on super players. And that was the real deal for this stuff. And as we were mentioning before we came on the air, guys like Tracy G from Dio, guys like Mark Kendall, who was coming up at the time, didn't have a band. I mean, this is what gave these guys the itch. Mark Kendall told me a great story that he saw David Lee Roth at, in a kind of a biker bar in L.A. in like 1977 or something. And, you know, he
He's like, Dave, how are you making your band so big? And Rock gave him the whole shtick. He's like, you know, I'm just on the phone all the time talking to clubs, and you're just kind of going through his thing. And he said that was just, for him, made him even more want to be a rock star, you know, a successful musician, to have these guys be larger than life. And so it was such an incredible scene. And Bob's documentary did such a good job of bringing those voices back.
Right. And that's one thing I really liked about your book, too. What you just mentioned is the fact that you have guys like Tracy, you have guys like Mark. So not only do you have these people that maybe nobody, you know, ever heard of that were part of Van Halen's inner circle, and you give us that whole cast of characters, but there's also these other people, and just how much of an influence that Eddie had on them or that Dave had on them, and that you don't just bring them in once, that you have a recurring theme of all these different times that Tracy saw them, and you see this progression, and you match Tracy's story to Van Halen's story, and I really like the way you did that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I think one of the things that I really wanted to do, you know, I grew up playing guitar. I never got very good at it, but I was a guy who, you know, sort of hacked away in my bedroom for years. And, you know, I really wanted to, you know, like, just paint a picture of what Eddie's development as a guitar player was in this book, along with the development of Van Halen. And I thought, you know, after a while, I started hearing from guys like Tracy. I talked to Tracy G, and he'd say, hey, you should talk to this guy. Talk to this guy. And I ended up talking to a lot of guys who we wouldn't necessarily associate with the LA scene. For example, the guys in Dred Zeppelin, Gary Putnam and Carl Hafiz, were both the guys who played on that Dred Zeppelin record. But these are guys who used to see Eddie all the time. You know, they would go, so they're in a cover band, and they're seeing Van Halen get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they would go to the Starwood Club. They would go to the Whiskey and stand right there in front of Eddie. And so these guys, as pro guitar players now, you have the great perspective of them being like, you know, explaining basically how Eddie came to be at the forefront in LA and what he had that other guys didn't have. And so, yeah, that was one of the real things I wanted to bring, was the perspective of guys who really knew what, you know, what great guitar playing was.
Yeah, and, you know, you talk about that and Eddie's style and being the great guitar player. Another really cool facet of the book is the fact that throughout several different episodes in the book, you really delve into, you know, where that tapping came from. I mean, people seem to think that there's this thing that it blossomed full-fledged. And then on the other hand, you have these other kind of, you know, barstool arguments of who really started it and all that. But I love the way that you really broke it down into sections and gave it in small chunks and related it all back to different things. And I think that also, again, goes back to showing that as an example of his progression of a player and how he took something simple, and as he progressed, he did other things with it.
Yeah, I can give you a great example of that. When I talked to Carl Hassett, and again, he was the guitar player, played all the solos on that very successful Dred Zeppelin album. Great player. And, you know, he pointed out to me, he said, you know, the two things that we all associate with Eddie Van Halen, the whammy bar and the tapping, he's like, that didn't all come together for Eddie till early 1977. You know, he wasn't saying Eddie wasn't a monster player all along, but he's basically saying the two things that we became most associated really with Eddie's style, you know, his tremolo bar use and that, of course, the wild two-handed tapping technique, that all sort of came together for Eddie at the very end, right before they record Van Halen 1. And so, yeah, one of the things I was really interested in is, you know, what sparked Eddie in that? And I think Eddie's been a little reticent to talk about that stuff and maybe hasn't given the full story. And so I tried to do my best to sort of recapture and flesh out what was going on. You know, there were a couple guys around, like Harvey Mandel being one, a guitar player with Canned Heat, who did some kind of rudimentary tapping. And then there were other guys who were doing stuff but was putting their other hand on the neck, too, that Eddie almost certainly was aware of. You know, I think that was all kind of grist for the mill. Eddie was a guy who just saw the stuff and probably just processed it. And then he took it, of course, and took it a totally different direction. I mean, he turned it into something that no one had ever heard before. And so, you know, I think for a lot of Eddie Van Halen fans, there's sort of this, you know, like I am too. There's sort of this, he's the God, and he is, but, you know, he's human, and he learned from other people, but he took what he learned and made it into something that we all know was so spectacular and so special that it's never been equaled since.
We'll be right back.
And I like that for you as a guitar player and me as a guitar player, we kind of understand a lot of this. But for the layperson who's just that Van Halen fan, who doesn't play guitar, the fact that, you know, when your final analysis of that progression, you really broke it down into layman's terms in that it wasn't the fact that, you know, like you said, that, you know, Mandel was doing it and you know, you talk about ZZ Top doing a little bit of it and stuff. And people talk about Steve Hackett doing it and things.
Right,
the fact that Eddie took it and made it this whole other musical thing that no one had ever done before, but you broke it down so that the layman understood, oh, now I understand what's so unique about what he did.
You know, the thing too is it was great when I talked to Tracy and talked about that sort of what it was like when he first saw it. Yeah, you break it down into the small pieces, but I also wanted to get that the sensation of the guys who first saw it. And Tracy G was in the Whiskey, and he would go every weekend to see Van Halen. This is 1977. This is some months before they record the album. The album comes out in February 1978. So this is 6 months, 8 months before anyone else in the country had heard of Van Halen. He said he's standing in the Whiskey and go, and he just started doing that tapping, like that full-on Eruption-style tapping, and he said his jaw just dropped. And he said he looked around, I won't use the colorful language in the book, but he said he could tell all the guitar players' workers, all their jaws were dropped, too. You know, it was just like, this is like, you know, he said that every time he thought you were even getting close to trying to do something that Eddie could do, he would come up with something better and something different. He just basically said he dropped his head. He's like, this guy's the king. This guy's going to, you know, this guy's going to change the world of guitar playing, and then he did.
Yeah,
he did, cool. And it was just, yeah, it was about trying to, in the book, lay those pieces down along the way to show people that, yeah, Eddie went from Eric Clapton to what he eventually became, but there were a lot of stops along the way, and Eddie was always the guy who just seemed to be able to take things farther than other people and do more with it.
Hmm. Now, you had, you know, you talked to a huge number of people in this book. I was blown away with the number of people that you did talk to, which must have been an incredible amount of work. But did you also try to approach any other former managers or, you know, anyone else in the band besides Michael Anthony to talk to you at all? Or?
Well, here's the interesting thing. I was told for the longest time that Noel Monk had died. Now, Noel Monk was the tour manager for Van Halen in 1978. Hmm. It actually turns out that he is not deceased, but I didn't find that till after the fact. And but putting that aside, I talked to Marshall Burl, who actually was their manager. So he was their business manager while Noel Monk was their tour manager.
Right.
Had long conversations with him, and then worked to really try to get interviews with the guys who were involved, and girls actually who were involved in the making of the first record. So there was two or three assistant engineers I talked to, and then Don Landy and Ted Templeman, the team behind the making of the first record. And so the other thing is I talked to one of the guys who went out on the road with them. Unfortunately, two of the guys who were Van Halen's roadies in that time period have died. And so, sort of, you know, they didn't have a huge crew at the time. But yeah, I did really try to get to those folks. And as you allude to, I actually approached Eddie and Dave via their media people, and they both eventually declined the interview request, which is, you know, was just at the end of my writing of the book, and I was disappointed. But at that point, I had so much material, it was sort of like, well, you know, the book is coming out one way or the other, so it's all good. But it was, you know, yeah, Michael Anthony was an absolute prince of a guy to talk to, the nicest guy you can imagine. I'm not sure if you guys have talked to him, but can't say enough nice things about him, the best guy.
Right. And the fact that you had so many people and all of their stories that they told you all seemed to cross over each other as well. So, I mean, anyone that would think like, oh, well, it can't be possibly all true because he hasn't talked to Dave or Eddie. I mean, you've got a pretty fairly fleshed out story there and an amazing one.
Well, yeah, I think the thing is that one of the ways to think about the book is that, you know, one day, hopefully, Eddie and Alice will write their biographies, or maybe they'll write a joint biography. And I'd love to read that. And we have Dave's book. Dave's written his book. You know, my thinking was, as much as I would have liked those guys to participate, I was also interested in talking to the people who threw the backyard parties.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole chapter in the book about the backyard parties that were thrown. One of the big ones in Pasadena, a huge one, 1974, that was broken up by the riot police. I wanted to get the perspective of the people who were there, the guys who threw it. And that was really important to sort of explain the Van Halen legend, because you start to talk to people, and I would talk to people from Pasadena, and I talked to five people, and they talk about this party, and I started to be like, well, you know, it sounds like it was a pretty big party. And I talked to 10 people about the same party. In other words, this is a huge event in the history of people who grew up at that time period, who were 17, 18 at the time. I mean, this party they still talk about.
Right.
And then you end up talking to the people who threw the party. And I ended up interviewing the two sisters and the brother who threw the party.
Mm.
And you really can get a full-on story. Then I found a newspaper article didn't mention Van Halen, but certainly mentioned there were 1,000 people at least in the backyard when the cops first showed up at the party. You know, and then you start to really understand how popular Van Halen was and what a sensation they were in LA. And this is 1974. This is 4 years before anyone's heard of Van Halen. So, yeah, my thinking was, you know, if we know that it's likely, and I knew that from the beginning, was unlikely that Dave or Eddie would have participated in the book, I want to get the perspectives of everybody else I can who was around to give me that full portrait, and the reader the full portrait of that whole scene and the whole time period.
Yeah, and I have to say that that Battle of Pasadena chapter was amazing. I mean, you put the little teaser in the beginning of that chapter, and it just sucks you in. You have to read everything on that chapter, and it is amazing. And, you know, the fact that you're reading the first party that the Imlers threw, and you're thinking, oh, geez, wait a minute. So this thing got bigger, and you read further on the chapter, and that, you know, the insane final party, and it's pretty mind-blowing to try to wrap your head around, like, how amazing that was.
You know, part of it was that you have... I think, as I tried to point out in the book, I mean, it was just a time period where the kids who were in junior high school in 1969 kind of grew up with understanding about Woodstock and Altamont and these big festivals. And now they're 18 years old. You know, they decide they want to throw these big parties in their backyard. You know, there was a couple of places in Pasadena, a couple of neighborhoods where there were very, very big yards, very big lots, with ranch houses on the front, and then, you know, some couple acres at the back, and this was just one of these houses, and they, you know, they wanted to have a big party, and they just went out and did it. And, you know, of course, once Van Halen's involved, the Van Halen brothers by 1974 have been gigging around Pasadena for something like 4 years. I mean, I'm talking about back when they're 15, you know, they're little kids basically gigging, and the reputation, though, was that Van Halen's getting really playing music. And so now this band has gotten real popular around Pasadena. Everyone knows about David Lee Roth and Van Halen in Pasadena. And so when the word comes out, hey, Van Halen's going to play in the backyard for a buck and all the beer you can drink. I mean, there are kids from all over LA, not just Pasadena, all over LA, because the flyers went all over. Mm-hmm. And it becomes this riot in the middle of this suburban neighborhood. So yeah, it was an amazing story, and I was lucky to be the one to be able to tell it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and another great thing I think that the book brings out that people may not realize is that how late in the game that they actually finally played an all originals show, you know, that, I mean, Golden West Ballroom, you know, some people that they'll see like that bootleg out there and they don't understand, you know, what that bootleg really represents. But the fact that like that was when they finally were the Van Halen that we all know.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is a bootleg that's supposedly from that show, but it's actually a cut and paste from a bunch of different shows. Hmm. But nonetheless, right, the whole idea of the UFO Van Halen show, that was a big, big crossover point for those guys. I have a couple of interviews from local papers with Dave from 1977 when Van Halen started making a name for themselves talking about this, that they had to decide, basically, do you want to be the top 40 band that makes good money every weekend? You can play in these top 40 clubs. You play in the Sunset Strip. You can make a living. Or do they want to roll the dice and say, we're going to play our own material, and people might not like it? You know, in other words, our original songs might not be good enough to hold up. And they take the risk to say, okay, we're going to actually roll out our first all-original gig in front of this big crowd at this concert hall that was called the Golden West Ballroom. It was actually an old Western swing dance ballroom, so kind of it's a big wooden floor with a stage room in front of UFO. And we're basically going to put all our cards on the table and go, okay, here's what we have. We've got Run with the Devil. We've got Somebody Get Me a Doctor. We've got House of Pain. We're going to play these songs, and we're going to play it in front of a hometown crowd. But we're going to play in front of UFO, which obviously is a pro band, very successful. And it worked out really, really well for those guys. But it was a huge risk, because part of what ends up happening is once you start to become an original band, you can't keep doing covers very well, because people are like, well, you know, what are you guys? You guys a cover band or are you an original band? And so these guys, you know, were going to make the big move and potentially lose their paying gigs at some of these clubs that were paying them to pay top 40 songs all night long. City called the Bridge.
And I love the whole part you talked about them, you know, the fact that you maybe slip one or two songs in a set of originals. Because I can remember doing that. You'd have clubs that would hire you, and you had originals, and it would just be like, the crowd's going good. Let's slip the original in. All right. So, that definitely brought it back.
No. One of the guys I talked to, this guy named Tom Broderick, who was one of their roadies, who was their sound guy. He talked about how, like, you know, sometimes the people be so drunk and they just, you know, you just have the same tempo, right? You just keep playing it as an original song, and people never even really noticed it wasn't a Bad Company song. They were kind of a little bit drunk, and that's the way you sort of start, you know, getting people into your music. You're like, yeah, what was that last song you played? Hey, that was an original. I'll play it again next set. You know, we liked it. And so
you always wait till the second set to do that. Never the first set. People aren't drunk enough. The second set that's when you do it. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing that I took away anyways, in my opinion, reading the book, is that you definitely were stepping up here to be a real cheerleader for David Lee Roth and his role. And, you know, the amount of bashing that his voice might have gotten and all that, that it seems like you did have a mission there to really put in perspective what Dave's really, what his role was in making that band what it was.
If, you know, I have to tell you, when I started working on the book, so I started really working on it in 2009, and I took some breaks along the way. But when I started the book, I would have never thought that that's the way the book would have come out. I was an Eddie guy all the way. I certainly wasn't trying to, you know, slug David Lee Roth. But, you know, he's sort of this, as a guitar player, you think, is Eddie's riffs. Eddie wrote the music. Eddie was the guy who shocked the world with his guitar playing in 1978. But the more people I talked to, and the more I started to understand what the Van Halen brothers' musical approach was before they teamed up with Dave, I really started to understand more and more how Dave, his influence, really made Van Halen a commercially successful band. And so when the brothers first pair up with David Lee Roth, they're playing Black Sabbath, they're playing Grand Funk, they're playing whole sides of Live at Leeds, they're playing that type of stuff. They might play some top 40, but they really don't like to do it. Like at backyard parties, they like to play hard, heavy music, Cactus, Captain Beyond, kind of like what we call, you know, the proto-metal stuff. Mm. And when Roth joins, Roth makes the case to those guys. He talks about this in his book, Roth, in many interviews he's talked about this, that we're never going to get anywhere as a band if we keep playing 20-minute Grand Funk songs or all of Toad from the live albums from Cream. That's great that you guys can do that, but we're never going to get any gigs that pay any money other than backyard parties. And so he starts to teach, I guess, the other guys about the idea that, look, we can start to shift our musical approach a little bit. And it's sort of a push and pull. But one song I thought was really interesting that I talked about in the book, I interviewed a guy who was the keyboard player for a year for Van Halen. They had an organist in 1973. He talked about when they brought when Rock joined the band, he wanted to do Superstition. And the brothers were like, well, we want to do Superstition too. And we do that. And the brothers did it like Beck, Bolger, and Apathy, like the heavy metal sort of hard rock style. And of course, Rock, who came from much more of a top 40, even, you know, he was really heavily influenced by R&B, by black music. He wanted to do a Stevie Wonder style and sort of like found a way to kind of make those two things mix together, you know, and that was always the push and pull to get the classic Van Halen song sound.
Yeah.
The other key point, I think, is the harmonies. Roth was a big advocate of bringing harmonies to Van Halen's sound. The brothers didn't like to sing particularly. Eddie sang lead, but didn't like to do it. And they didn't do very many songs with harmonies where Roth wanted to do more of that, that almost like Beach Boys, that Temptation style background vocals on different songs they would write or they would cover, because it gave it sort of a pop sweetness. And that was, again, that's all that was sort of comes together. So you keep the heavy metal guitar, you keep the screams, you keep all that stuff. But when you get to Van Halen 1, you know, you have that Feel Your Love Tonight with those harmonies, and that's very, very much of a pop sensibility. And that's sort of the push and pull between Roth and the brothers, for sure.
Yeah. And I like some of the stories, you know, you really brought out about that push to change. One of my favorites in the book is the whole idea of Dr. Roth hiring the choreographer and then learning all the choreography, then going to Gazzari's and the stage with the pole in the middle and the stairs, and they can't even do all the choreography. That was a great story.
You know, yeah, so Roth had a band before he joined Van Halen. Well, let me step back. So in 1971 or so, Roth approaches the Van Halen brothers, who have their own band at the time called Mammoth. I believe it's called Mammoth then. They approached him and they say, Roth said, hey, I can sing for you because Eddie's singing. So Eddie doesn't like to sing lead very much. And Alex says, well, all right, let's check this guy out. And the story goes that Roth auditions at the Van Halen's house in Pasadena. The audition goes very, very badly. Roth doesn't come off well as a singer. And they say, no, you can't sing for us. And Roth gets very insulted, very mad, and he storms out. And he ends up forming his own group called Red Ball Jet. And I ended up talking to three of the guys who were in Red Ball Jet with Roth. So this is a year before he joined Van Halen. This is 1972. And again, this is a high school band, like, just so we understand. This is not like a, you know, this isn't in his 20s. This is their, like, 17, 18-year-old guys doing this. But Roth, in that band, all the things that later on he wanted to kind of bring to the Van Halen show, the crazy clothing, the dance moves, all the stuff that later, if you think about it, what ends up happening with Roth on the, you know, 1984 tour, with the kicks, the spins, the funky clothing, all the way that Eddie dressed, the way that Dave dressed, you know, they all dressed in these flashy clothing during Van Halen's peak. And you can kind of get back to that. And, you know, yes, Roth even convinced his father to hire a Motown choreographer to come in and basically help the band members of Red Ball Jet learn how to dance better. And, of course, you know, if you're in high school and you're on the lunch table and you hear, oh, this guy's in Red Ball Jet, they have a choreographer, you think that's the craziest thing you've ever heard in your life. You think, this guy's a loser, or these guys are insane. But of course, Rock had his vision. He wanted to be an entertainment first guy. He had his vision of what music should be, and he pushed for it. And, you know, later on, of course, all the things that sort of were the seed there, I think, in Red Ball Jet, Roth's first group, kind of come to full fruition in Van Halen. I don't mean musically so much, but I just mean the whole idea of putting on a show. Roth understood you have to put on the show. The Van Halen brothers' idea of a show before Roth joined, they stand there in their flannel shirts, and they'd play music perfectly. Their hair would hang in their face. Eddie would smoke his cigarettes. He wouldn't move. He'd sing into the microphone. And that was it. It was just like the heavy, hard music. And there was no show. But Roth, of course, brought the show to Van Halen and taught those guys, like, Eddie, how to move around and do their things.
Yeah. And you really do bring out in the book that there's just that it's the vision. Like you just said, he's got this unrelenting vision, and he's just going to make it happen. And this amazing force of will that David Lee Roth has, and the book really brings that out with everybody that talks about him.
I think, you know, and I think the thing too is that you're dealing with a guy in Eddie who, as we all know, has had his issues with chemicals over the years. He's been honest about the fact that he's an insecure person. He doesn't like that, you know, he's, you know, would get so nervous he would have to drink every time before he went on stage. And Dave, you know, obviously it's the opposite of that. He may have gotten nervous, but of course he was all about being on the stage. That was where he lived and he wanted to live. And I think that sort of pushing that vision forward to say, we can be the biggest band in the world, and we can put on this great show for everybody, getting Eddie to move around like we talked about, getting Eddie to basically be confident. And there's those episodes in the book where, in fact, going back to Tracy told me that he bumped into David Lee Roth in the club, and, you know, Dave basically goes, we're going to blow UFO away. And then, you know, and Tracy, the 6-year-old kid, he's like, what are you talking about? You know, like, looking at him, like, are you nuts? They have Michael Schenker. they're, you know, they're a pro group. They're on Chrysalis Records. What are you talking about? You guys aren't even in a sign. You know, Dave's are going to blow him off the stage, and just walked away. And Tracy said Brock was 100% serious. And I think that was part of that sort of pumping up those other guys to be like, you know what, we can do this. We can be a contender and knock these other guys off this road.
The way you wrote that up is absolutely just amazing. Another cool thing that I like in here is, you know, talking about the whole recording of that first album. Mm-hmm. Now, how hard was it for you to actually do all the research and get that literally like day by day timeline? Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. I mean, how much work was it to get that together?
Well, one big thing that was important, and that was I was able to get the tape box scans from Warner Brothers. And so once I was able to get those, so they have the reels in the archive at Warner Brothers, and they've actually taken and scanned them. And so you can actually see the dates that the things were recorded, what was worked on the tracks. That was really important to break it down day by day. But the other thing, of course, is that I talked to Landy and Templeman and then three of the assistant engineers who worked on the record. And so that was a critical importance for doing this. And Templeman was the guy really who was enormously helpful to me, because he was willing to say, look, this is what I tried to do with Van Halen, and go through it with me. I'm like, you know, talk about Atomic Punk, and he'd be like, which one is that? And we talk about it, and he'd go, oh yeah, I remember that song. We would talk at length about Atomic Punk. And he was also, you know, I think really, really helpful in getting me to understand, you know, his full vision for Van Halen, which was to basically find what Dave does well, but then play it up. In other words, you have this great guitar player, and he basically is this guy, you know, whatever he plays is pretty much going to be incredible. You have a good drummer, you have a good bass player, they're right there. And let's really work with Dave to shine on him all the things that he does better than other things he does. And so Templeman was saying that, look, Roth is not the greatest natural singer. We all know that. He's not a virtuoso opera singer, but he's got things he does well, the screams, the yelps, the little things. Get him to relax, and we're going to work on this stuff in the studio. And Templeman was enormously helpful, and Landy too, in getting me to understand how this all came about. And it's just, you know, as we all know, it's an absolutely spectacular debut record.
Yeah, I am extremely jealous that you got to talk to Ted Templeman and Don Landy. For the number of producers and engineers we've had on the show, I mean, that to me is definitely two dream interviews. And just, you know, you read through, and it looks like they just gave you so much amazing information about what happened.
You know, it was really, I got to say, it was really an honor to talk to those guys, obviously. I mean, you know, you're good on the phone, you're like, this is Ted Templeman. It was, you know, it was like talking to Dave or Eddie, and no disrespect to Dave and Eddie. I think we all as Van Halen fans know how important Ted's work and Don's work too were on those records and making those things so magical. But, you know, Ted's a very smart guy, and I think he's very proud of what he did with Van Halen. I think he knows that those guys were a once-in-a-lifetime band. And this is the guy, of course, who's worked with Clapton, worked with Little Feat. I mean, we go down the list of people he's worked with. It's an incredible Aerosmith. I mean, but he knows that those Van Halen records were special. And I think when he got the sense that I was serious about doing this book in a way that wasn't going to be just sort of a drive-by, two paragraphs on the making of the first record, but I really wanted to understand how it all came about to work so well. He was willing to be really, you know, spend some time with me, which is fantastic.
Yeah, and another interesting thing on here too is that, I mean, a lot of people now, they know the latter day Van Halen, they know Eddie's personality now and Alex's personality now, but it's stunning to just read it in print, the fact that they were not involved with the mixing and mastering first album. I mean, it's a mind-blowing statement.
Ted told me that, yeah, you know, things changed in 1984. Certainly Van Halen fans like you and I know that the balance of power began to shift, and Ted was sort of sidelined by Eddie and Don Landy, that they had their own vision for 1984, and they thought that Ted might crimp their style, basically, so they were doing sessions when Ted wasn't around, and so, you know, sort of basically, and I think Ted looks back on it now with a bit of a sense of humor, but at the time, I think it was a pretty stressful thing where the producer can't get into the studio because it's Eddie's home studio, and he's not able to really get his hands on the reels when he wants to. But yeah, early on, Ted, you know, said for the first four or five albums, that he and Don mixed it on their own. And it was just this thing that Ted always said that he made mistakes in the past with other artists where you let them sit in on the mix, and then before you know it, like, you're just, you know, it's just the egos of the artists and their insecurities get so big and so heavy into the situation that it's very hard to get the producer and the engineer's work properly documented. So I don't think Ted meant it to be like those guys were incompetent to be able to have opinions. I just always said, I want to give it my shot first. And so they mixed it first. And he said that those guys never complained until of course, things went, you know, things didn't work out in the end with Ted and Van Halen. They went their separate ways in 84. But, you know, that he said that they never complained about this stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, you listen to those albums even now, and they just hold up incredibly well. They don't sound truly dated. And I think there's a lot of people that still record now that try to capture that type of sound.
It's interesting too. I was talking to Ted recently, and he and I were talking, and I mentioned to him that Alex and Eddie, to some extent, but definitely Alex, has said in interviews that he wished, in retrospect, that Van Halen 1 had sounded like more like a Led Zeppelin record. You know, and with all respect to Alex, I think if that had happened, I'm not sure that it would have had the same power. You know, I just think it might have been sort of, how would I put it? It might have just seemed like another, you know, Zeppelin rehash, maybe in some sort of way. The fact that Ted mixed it in a way that, to me, didn't sound like, it certainly sounded like the Montrose record, but it didn't sound like a lot of other rock records that are being made at that time. It's interesting. And I think that's what Ted's point was about, you know, the artists can have their opinion, you know, but it's important for the engineer and the producer to mix it first. Then we sit down and listen. And if people really have strong opinions, I'll change it. But Ted said that those guys didn't, you know, at the time, you know, they were new to the industry, and suddenly they weren't going to stand up and just pound the table and say, Ted, you did it wrong. We wanted to sound like Led Zeppelin too. But it's interesting to think about if those guys that had their way, how different Van Halen 1 might have sounded if they, you know, they had the able to ability to mix it.
Right. And if they had done that, then they really would have made Bill O'Coin's words true, with Bill calling them derivative. If they'd made it Van Halen, they would have satisfied that. Absolutely.
I think that's the thing, is that Ted understood maybe better than anybody what a virtuoso Eddie was. You know, Ted made the point to me that he said that Eddie, because Ted was a jazz guy, that Ted grew up playing bebop and was a guy who had a long musical career. He was in a pop group called Harper's Bazaar in the late 60s and had been around, that Ted understood that Eddie was a guy who was just so unusual as a talent. And then what Ted does, he goes in the studio and goes, okay, you know, I'm going to take the best of Dave, I'm going to make that front and center of the record, maybe put back the, you know, the rhythm section a little bit, and Eddie's guitar is going to dominate the entire record. And that was the right move. I mean, I think everybody agrees that if you had done, you know, you basically got Eddie, you know, you got to play a little less, you know, a little less good solo, play more of a melodic solo here. Don't do your, you know, whatever. If he had tried to handcuff Eddie, it would have completely, to me, short-circuited the power of Van Halen completely. And so you got to give Ted a lot of credit for going, Eddie's incredible. This guy is the greatest guitar player I've ever laid eyes on. Nobody knows about him. And I'm going to make him the centerpiece of the record. Yeah, Dave too, definitely. But Eddie's guitar playing is going to be what everyone remembers about the record. Right. And that's what happened.
And if, you know, it had been a Zeppelin type of record, they probably never would have had Eruption on there. I mean, that was you never saw a Jimmy Page solo spot showcase like that on a record. And just, you know, to have that. And I mean, how important do you think, you know, in your own opinion, that having Eruption on that first album was in sealing their reputation?
Listen, I think particularly because Eddie did it every night on the road afterwards. You know, it's sort of, by putting it on the record, it sort of made it something that Eddie needed to do every night. And he was already doing it live, but I think that was sort of, now it's obvious you have to do it if it's on the record. I think anybody who saw Van Halen on the first tour, and of course I didn't, I know you grew up with the records, you understand that when you drop that needle on Eruption the first time, and it's 1978, you're thinking, wait, it's not Robin Trower. It's not, this is not a Bad Company. This is not H. Freely. And again, no offense to those players, but this is something wholly different. And the other irony here is that that was recorded at the very end. Mm. The story goes that that Alex, Eddie, and Mike Anthony were warming up in the Whiskey, just sort of like, you know, running through some stuff because they had the studio and they were running through stuff they were going to play live at the Whiskey. And Ted walks in and he hears Eruption. He's like, the tapping. He's like, what's that? And he's like, oh, that's just something I fool around with on stage. He's like, let's roll the tape. Let's put this together. And, you know, they talked about whatever the parts were going to be, however they put it together in a few minutes, the pre-production really quick, and they rolled tape. And of course, that's the game changer right there. And, I think if that hadn't been on the record, I mean, it's sort of like a great athlete who you're not letting show off all their skills on the playing field. Eddie was the guy, you know, was going to revolutionize guitar for the 1980s. And Dave was saying it on the 78 tour, he would yell it out. You know, you're ready for the electric guitar of the 1980s? And he predicted the future. That was it. Eddie was the electric guitar of the 1980s. And yeah, I mean, to think that that was just sort of an afterthought, that was the last track they recorded, I believe. That was the last track they recorded. Jamie's Crying, and they did Eruption. That was it. And that was the album was done. And to think that's the, of course, that's the guitar playing thing that we all remember from that record.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can just remember I would annoy the hell out of my neighbors because I would drop the needle on that and I would put it through my guitar amps and just crank it. And they used to hate me because, yeah. You know, you'd have this just burst of, and they didn't know what the hell was coming out of the windows. But yeah, just mind blowing when you first hear that. I mean, a lot of people now, they probably don't realize it, but for those of us in 78 listening to that, it was like, holy crap, what is this?
And of course, right, you didn't have the advantage that Tracy had. Like, Tracy G, in the summer of 1977, sees it. So he knows what Eddie's doing. Like, he sees the second hand on the neck, right? But everybody else, who doesn't really know about the technique. They're like, what, that two guitars? How many guitar players are in there? How many overdubs are there? Well, none. It's just the one track, you know? It stands out to me as the absolute peak of guitar playing over the last 40, 50 years.
And you just talked about, you know, Jamie's Crying being one of the songs that comes in at the end. And if I remember correctly from the book, that was actually a song that was just added at the end, right? Like a last-minute written-up song.
Yeah, it's interesting, that song. You know, the story goes that they had the riff, they had the beat, but they didn't have any lyrics, and they really didn't have a full song. And what Ted told me, and I think we talk about it in the book, is that, you know, Ted was really concerned about making sure there was enough stuff to play on Top 40 radio for the record. And here again, where Ted deserves, I think, a lot of credit. Ted knew from his experience with Montrose, right, you have this incredible band, Montrose, comes out in 1973. You got Sammy Hagar, great singer. You got this great rhythm section. You got this killer guitar player, Ronnie Montrose. The album never hit big because they didn't have a hit single. Now again, Rock Candy got played on the radio, Bad Motor Scooter got played on the radio, but you never had that sort of breakthrough Top 40 hit. Mm. Ted says to the band, we need to have a cover song. We're going to put a cover song, because I don't think any of the originals are really great fits for Top 40 radio when they went to record the record. So they do You Really Got Me. But at the end of the session, that they work up, Ted hears this riff again, and they're talking about it, and they're working on the song. The guys are writing the song, and Ted said, let's, you know, this is the pop song, Jamie's Crying, which is for sure a pop song. So they record that at the very end of the session there. And of course, that becomes a single eventually off Van Halen 1, and, you know, I think that's the thing too that Ted understood from his own experiences in the industry, especially at that moment in time where hard rock maybe again was sort of maybe not as popular as it had been back in 1973, it was really important to have a song that was going to get on the radio and make an impact. And You Really Got Me sounds like a buzzsaw coming through the radio in 1973 with that riff, the way they played it. And again, give a lot of credit to Ted, to, you know, even though later years Eddie has been vocal about the fact he doesn't like the cover songs, I think Ted's notion to say it's important to have a song that's going to be played on the radio to get your name out there was an important one.
You know, I'm glad you brought up Montrose, because another nice thing in the book that doesn't get talked a heck of a lot about is the fact that, you know, Sammy Hagar's name was bandied about, mm-hmm. you know, way back in that part of Van Halen history as a potential Dave replacement. And I really like that the book has that in there.
So the story goes, you know, Ted had talked about this before, but I think now it's in this book. It's sort of being blasted on the internet by Blabbermouth and about Anti-Music and some of these other websites that have been talking about my book. But Ted had talked about it before. Basically, the story goes that when Ted saw Van Halen in February 1977 at a club called the Starwood Club in Hollywood, he was completely enraptured by Eddie. Now, he thought the rest of the band was good, don't get me wrong, but he was like so into Eddie's playing, he's like, I'm signing this band. They signed the band, and so they recorded a demo soon after that. And Ted, when he listens to the demo tape, he just doesn't think Dave has a compelling voice. You know, he doesn't think he's a terrible singer necessarily, but he just thinks he's, you know, he may not be a good enough singer for this band. So the story goes that Ted is to himself, maybe talk to Don Landy, maybe one other people, Warner Brothers, kind of whispering in the hallway going, God, I don't know if this guy can do it, if this singer can do it. If he can, you know, maybe I call Sammy, because Sammy had worked with Ted in Montrose, and of course, Sammy's a great singer. But the story goes that Dave worked really hard on improving his vocals, took some vocal lessons in 1977, and then Ted also, along the way, sees Dave's vocals improve, but he also began to understand that Dave is a great songwriter, that, you know, it's easy to look at Dave and say he's the guy who's high on stage and, you know, doesn't do this right, doesn't do that right, he's not a particularly good this and that, but Dave was a good songwriter, and Dave wrote the lyrics, Dave helped with the hooks of those songs. And Ted said, this guy writes great lyrics, and this guy's smart. He's talking about love and all these other great lyrics that end up on the first record. And Ted said, okay, we're going to work with this guy. And then again, that's what I meant about Ted saying, we're going to figure out what you do well, Dave, and then we're going to do a lot of that on the record, and things you don't do well, we're going to stop doing in the recording studio. And so I think Ted really helped to coach up Dave a little bit. And Dave worked his ass off, too. I think Dave understood you're in a band with a virtuoso guitar player. Dave knew that. And, you know, he had to raise his game a little bit. And to me, Dave Roth is one of the great American success stories, because on paper, there's no reason why Dave Roth should become a rock star in 1972. I mean, on paper, there's no reason for it. But the guy did it. I mean, the guy absolutely transcends. As a New York Jets fan, if I may use the analogy of Tom Brady, right, which I hate to do, by the way, but, you know, it's a sixth-round draft choice out of Michigan, right? On paper, this guy's not going to be a Hall of Famer, but he worked his ass off, and he's got that natural talent, and he just absolutely has shown that, you know, he's dominant, and that's, I think, what Rock did, too.
Mm. So, you know, with all the great things about the book, I have one small personal thing about the book that I'm kind of bummed at, and that's that there wasn't more pictures in the book. Now, granted, you had one that I was so happy you had in there, because I've never seen it, and that was the original album cover. And, you know, you talk about it, and then a couple pages later, you actually see it. And I was like, oh, God, it's in here. This is awesome.
But
I just was like, especially when you look on the cover, you see some of those old gig flyers and things. And I wish there were, you know, maybe more of those and some other stuff in there. Now, was there ever any thought about putting more photos in the book at the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I wanted to do with the book is that I wanted it to have photographs in the book that no one had ever seen before, for the most part, that had not been published. So I think 99% of the pictures in the book had never been published before. And so that was my thinking in trying to do images with the book. I think, of course, I would have liked to have more images in the book. That also comes down to compromises with the press as well, because the more photos you put in the book, the more it drives up the price of the book, the more you drive up the price of the book, the less people that might buy it. And so it's sort of like a balancing act there. But I was hoping when we put the book together that the people would sort of see these pictures of Eddie and Dave from 1975 and it's, you know, in the platform shoes that had never been published before, those guys digging outside where Eddie's playing the original, what became the Shark guitar, his Ibanez guitar and stuff like that might make up for a little bit of that. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair critique of the book. In retrospect, you know, maybe another 10 pictures would have made a big difference. But again, it's just, you know, it's these types of things you're trying to balance all the different factors when you're working with the press and have it to, you know, make the book not be so expensive that it might sway people from buying it, because it's not a photo book primarily, right? Mm. You want to sort of find that sweet spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is such a cool book, and I'm not just saying it because I'm talking to you, but this is such a cool book. This, if it was a hardcover, I would have bought the hardcover. It really is everything that it was advertised to be. And some books fall short in that case, but this book is absolutely everything that it was advertised to be.
I appreciate that. You know, and there was actually a talk about doing a special hardback edition, and maybe that will happen down the road. It was, again, one of these things with the timing as well. If we had put out a hardback edition, it would have delayed the publication of the paper, because they would have wanted to roll out the hardback first, then roll out the paper. And so I wanted to get the book to press out as quickly as possible. I've been talking about the book for a couple of years with people, and I really wanted it to be out. And if the calls for a deluxe edition of the book with hardcover with more pictures, I'm all in. You know, I'm definitely all in. And I think, it just, for me, yeah, it was meant to be my tribute to my fandom and my love of the band, and also just my hope that people who will check out this book, yeah, who may be disappointed by some other books, not just Van Halen books, but books in general, they feel sort of let down. I really wanted people to come away and go, hey, this guy said he was going to tell these untold stories about the early days of the band and how Van Halen made it, and really trace their genesis from a backyard party band to Bland that could blow Sabbath off the stage and win stadium crowds over. I hope I was able to accomplish that, because that's really what I wanted to know as a fan. That's why I was so driven into this book. I was tired of not knowing, how did this all come together for this band? How did they become so damn good in 1978?
Yeah, and I think for you, for this being your first trade book, you also didn't make the mistake that happens a lot of times in trade books, and that's that it's extremely balanced. You don't take an inordinate amount of time on one particular subject and then rush through some other thing that other people mm-hmm. might be interested in, that every single chapter is extremely balanced one to the next. That's something I think it's a pitfall a lot of people get into, but you've totally nailed it on this one.
Yeah, there's so much stuff I had to leave out too. So we alluded to the fact that in a lot of interviews, I did something like 230, I stopped counting, it was like 238 or something like that. I mean, there was an enormous amount of material. I talked to guys like Audie Desborough, a great white, who actually ended up within a band that opened for Van Halen. And there were some great stories I had to leave out. But it's also about making those compromises. You're like, oh, I don't want to leave this story out. But like you're saying, you know, then you end up cramming all this stuff into one chapter. And then because the book is getting too long, you go, well, I'm going to cut this part short. And so it was about, again, trying to think about, how do I trace the story as best I can? And again, maybe not being able to tell all those great stories I wanted to, but really get the highlights that people understand. Hey, what was it like when these guys were playing biker bars and playing t-shirt contests, and were really working their asses off? And then what was it like when they were opening for Sabbath? What was that like? And really try to capture that part as well. But yeah, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
And of course, you know, the million-dollar question is, now that you've whetted all our appetites with right up through Van Halen 1 and that first tour, are you thinking at all about maybe continuing and looking at, you know, maybe doing Van Halen 2, or are you pretty much happy with what you accomplished with this one?
I would love to see anyone else to write a book that really, really got into the nitty gritty detail of the band's peak, you know, basically up through 1986 or 85 or however we did it. I said this before, and this is not meant to be any sort of, laying down the gauntlet for those guys, but I think it would be difficult to do that type of book without the participation of the band members. Mm. And I only say this to be honest, to be totally honest with the audience here, is that you can imagine as the band gets more famous, their circles get smaller and smaller and smaller, right? Right. It's not like David Lee Roth is walking around Pasadena anymore at backyard parties where you could, you know, people would talk to him and they would see this stuff. You become more removed as the star. And so, you know, without the artist, I mean, I could write the book, and I'm not saying it couldn't be done, but I think it would be difficult to do it justice. And so the advantage I had with this book was, again, we're talking about 90% of the book is about the period of time when they're not famous. And so they were able to really mix with a lot of people that later on, you just become, you know, more of a cloistered person by 1982. You're just not, you know, Eddie's married to Valerie. He's not hanging out in Pasadena, driving around with people who went to high school with. And so it's a different deal. So I would, in theory, love to do another book like this. I would just hate to raise expectations. Oh, this guy, you know, he's going to write the follow-up, and then people read it and go, oh, you know, there's not that much here. It's all, you know, it's just because I wouldn't have the material to really get into the the story the way I did with this one.
Mm. No, that's a good point, and totally honest and candid on your part, and I appreciate that. And you're right. I think also that there's been this thing with Van Halen, and I think it's similar with AC/DC as well, that they do have that inner circle, and you know, if they, the person who's in that inner circle maybe talks too much, then they find themselves no longer in that inner circle anymore. So I think, yeah, you're probably right about the amount of your, you know, sources.
And there were people who, you know, and to be honest with you guys as well, I mean, there were people who wouldn't talk to me. You know, just there were, I won't get into the details, but there were certain people who declined interview requests who I would have liked to have interviewed outside the band as well. And, you know, for me, I had enough where it was not a big pitfall, and I had some ways to get around it. But yeah, I mean, again, right, when you're talking about a much smaller circle, and you start to have people who were closer to the band members, or were close in that sort of way when they were really famous, it could be a much harder sell to kind of make the case. But on the other hand, I would say, if I were to take on this topic again, I hope anyone who would have read this book would understand that I did it in a totally respectful way. I was not trying to dig dirt at the band. I was not trying to, you know, bring it all like sex and drug stories to make these guys into sort of an entertainment for all of us to sit back and be like, look what absolute decadent guys they were. I mean, they may have been, but it was not meant to be a sensationalistic book. And right. But I think that's, in understandably so, that's what any artist or any famous person fears, that somebody's going to take their story and then really just use it, just, you know, proclaim them in the worst possible light. So.
Right. Yeah. No, and you're right. I mean, definitely your book doesn't do that. I mean, some people might not think that, but it definitely is a respectful portrayal of the band. It's honest, and it's open, and it's very well done.
Well, I'm a fan. I mean, I think the thing is, like, you know, I've read some rock biographies. Maybe you have too. I remember reading this book about, it was the band The Police, and I just got the impression that the guy who wrote it didn't really like the band very much. You know, for me, it's not like hard to understand. It's like, you know, why would you want to write a rock biography if you didn't really, you know, feel passionate or enthused about the music? That doesn't mean you have to applaud everything the band does. And I tried to be honest where I think they made mistakes along the way. Certainly, for example, the Gene Simmons demo, which is on YouTube, we can listen to it. I don't think that is actually the shining moment in Van Halen's musical history. But, you know, there's also the sense that, you know, you want, certainly, I think, someone to write a rock biography who has a, has an enthusiasm for the band. And I certainly am a fan, no doubt about it.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, that absolutely comes through in the book. Yeah, without a doubt. So, of course, people, you know, reading the book and wanted to, you know, maybe read some other things or know what you're up to. And do you have any places on social media or a website or anything that people could keep tabs on what Greg's doing?
Yeah, sure. The best place to get me to hold of me is probably VanHalenRising.com, all one word. You can go there. Also, I'm on Twitter, at Greg Renoff, so that's at GREGRENOFF. I'm on Facebook at Van Halen, / Van Halen Rising, all one word. And yeah, I love hearing from people. I mean, I really, one of the great things about writing this book is that we live in an age where if somebody feels, you know, motivated to write to you, it's easy for them to get a message to either Twitter or Facebook, and they'll just tell you what they think about the book and what they like. And for me, that's a cool thing, is a lot of people have been taking pictures of the book and, you know, sort of putting them up on Facebook or on Twitter, and it's been fun. I mean, just to see people really embrace it and loving it, and it's been great. Because when you write a book like this, you do podcasts, you understand, you put something out there in the world, you don't know how people are going to react. Sometimes they like it, they don't like it, they get mad, this is not for them. And to have so many people say that they really enjoyed it has been a big satisfying thing, because I ultimately wrote it for myself because I wanted to write this book, but to have other people embrace it has been really a wonderful thing, and I'm really appreciative to everyone who's been so nice to reach out to me.
Yeah, and I think that really, I think that's the key, right? You wrote it for yourself. I mean, that was one of the things people always talk to, like, Peter Frampton and say, what the hell happened after Frampton Comes Alive? And he'll honestly tell you, I stopped writing for myself and started writing for the record companies and for hits and all that, and that's when everything fell apart for him. And so I think books are the same way. If you write them for yourself first, it's probably a better product.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think honestly, the book has been, to be frank with you, more successful than I thought it would be. I'm not saying that to be like sort of ultra modest or something, but, you know, it's now the number one heavy metal book on Amazon, which blows my mind. It totally blows my mind, because it was a book that I wrote as a fan for myself, and I thought it would be a book that, you know, your average Van Halen fan would get into, but it seems to have reached more people than that, and that's been really, really satisfying, because one of the things I was really hoping to make the case for about the book is that because of all the BS that's gone on with Sammy and Gary Cherone and Dave in and out of the band and all the drama over the years, I think it's sort of undercut Van Halen's power. You know, think about Zeppelin, where Zeppelin breaks up in 1980, and they leave the field as gods. Mm. Whereas with Van Halen, there's all this sort of, you know, like Van Halen 3 comes out and people don't like it, and I don't like Sammy, and I have this and that. And it's just sort of, I think, has sort of eroded away what you talked about earlier in the conversation, which is, you know, you dropped the needle on Van Halen 1, that was a world-changing experience for you. You know, that was, that changed your whole perspective on the world. And I think that kind of got lost in the shuffle a lot because of all the stuff that's gone on with Van Halen. And for me, I just wanted to sort of, you know, make the case that these guys work super hard and changed music history when they really, by all, you know, intents and purposes, were a band that probably, if Templeman hadn't come along, they may have had a lot of trouble getting a deal. They probably would have eventually, but, you know, Templeman was the guy who saw what they had and put them in a great light to succeed because they were great, a great talent, great songwriters. But, you know, they went against the grain and they still won out. It's a great story.
It is. And that's actually a great way to wrap it up. And of course, I got one final question for you. So off of Van Halen 1, I mean, what is your favorite track as a fan?
I think Running with the Devil. That's my favorite. It just really, to me, captures the entire Van Halen vibe. It's dark, it's heavy, has that great, great, great chorus. And of course, you know, the great Eddie solos that we all can hum to ourselves, like they Running with the Devil.
That is a great one. That one always stuck out to me as well. Back in 78, I was a bass player at that point. Just to have that Michael Anthony pumping bass line going in, it was like, yes, you know, it was a bass, it was on an album and you could hear it. Just an incredible track and a different tone and a different, it's that plodding thing as well. But for them, it's an amazing track.
Yeah. Just real quick. Yeah. I mean, all kudos to Gene Simmons for coming up with the car horn thing. Gene came up with that. That's on the Van Halen, Gene Simmons demo, that slowed down car horn. Kudos to Ted Templeman too for slowing that song down. Ted worked with those guys to say, you know what, you're playing it too fast. Let's make it more of a march. You know, like have more swagger to it. It's just like this bomb, bomb, instead of the way they used to play it. And it still makes it so powerful because it just sort of plods along and just you can't help but be moved by the song. So yeah, my favorite.
Greg, I'm glad that you were able to spend so much time with me tonight, and definitely for all you people listening, I really urge you to go out and pick up a copy of Greg Runoff's book, Van Halen Rising. Like you said, it is on Amazon. You can have it in your little sweaty metal palms within days. So it's well worth putting your metal dollars down for it.
Hey, so appreciate this opportunity. Thank you so much.
Hey, no problem, Greg. Thanks a lot.
We're going to give you a little bit of that bass guitar one time right here.
Hope you guys were digging that one. And again, you know, go out and get Van Halen Rising by Greg Runoff. Good stuff. And many last VH comments, Richie?
I wonder, will they actually record anything or tour again? I know that the recent tour got a little bit slammed. I think Roth is mailing it in a little bit.
Nah. Well, we'll see. But again, great book. I think if you want to get some really good insight, I think this book is going to do it for you. All right. But hey, it's good to finally have you back in the studio again.
I'm here.
You know, people
I'll be around.
Probably wondering, where the hell's Richie?
No, I'll be around.
So that's good. I'm sorry you missed the interview.
No, that's okay. Yeah. That's all right. I can't make them all.
But I did get all your questions in.
I know. I was like, fuck, ask him this one.
So, that's great. So, you know, in the meantime, You can keep up with us on focusonmetal.net, focusonmetal.blogspot.com. You can connect with Richie at our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter. So that's it for another week of Focus on Metal. Scott.
And Richie.
And until we talk to you again next week, remember,
focus on metal.
Everything else is insignificant.
It's over. Go home.